1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. He had three ships and left from Spain. He sailed through sunshine, wind, and rain. He sailed by night, he sailed by day. He used the stars to find his way. Columbus sailed on to find some gold to bring back home as he'd been told. He returned again in 1494. What does this have to do with fish? Listen ahead to find out more. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, or if you have a topic or person you want to hear on the podcast, you can reach out to me there or email me at feedback@fisheriespodcast.com. The episode today, as you may have figured out, is related to Columbus Day. We are not celebrating Mr. Columbus or getting into the conversation of his ethics, but rather discussing an observation that was made during one of his return trips. To help me along the way, I have invited Dr. Chris Kennealy to be our guest today. Chris grew up in New Hampshire fishing for brook trout. He received his Bachelor's of Science at Cornell University and before moving on to graduate school, worked at Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology, where he developed an interest in deep sea fishes. Chris then took his PhD at the University of Washington to study molecular evolution of visual systems and feeding biomechanics of dragonfishes. After his PhD, he returned to Harvard as postdoctoral scholar, where he used biorobotic models to study the feeding systems of fishes. He now works with a team of undergraduates to pursue research in swimming and feeding biomechanics at Boston College as an assistant professor of practice. At Boston College, he teaches courses in vertebrate physiology and biomechanics for majors, as well as a course for non-majors in the history of science and technology. Welcome to the podcast, Chris.
That's great to be here, Nick.
When I reached out to you, I just mentioned that I was wanting to do an episode about remoras for Columbus Day, and you didn't even ask any questions on how the two are connected. And if I was in your shoes, I'd be scratching my head as to how these two are related. As for the guests of this episode, would you mind first describing the remora to any listeners who may not know what it is?
Sure, yeah. Well, they're pretty fascinating fishes. The remoras, as a group, are eight species of all marine fishes. They live on reefs, they live offshore in the open ocean, and they're all tied together by this fascinating suction disc on top of their heads, and they use that to what we describe as hitchhike, that is, stick to other fishes, though some stick to whales, and hitchhike and take a free ride. From that standpoint, they're just fascinating in the sense that there aren't many vertebrates that just hitch onto something and take that free ride. So they're fascinating in that regard.
Now I suppose I'll fill you and the audience in on how it relates to Columbus Day. The instance occurred during Columbus's second voyage to the West Indies during 1494, and he was sailing near Cuba and decided to head towards Jamaica. And during that time, he stumbled across some small islands and came across some fishermen. Columbus kept journals of all his voyages, but when he would come back to Portugal or Spain, he would leave them with a guy to transcribe and publish. And somehow these original journals got lost. So the following is an excerpt from Ferdinand Columbus, The Life of Admiral Christopher Columbus by his son Ferdinand, which was later translated to English by Onsham and John Churchill in their collection of Voyages and Travels of Volume 2. In one of these channels, they spied a canoe of Indian fishermen who very quietly, without the least concern, swayed the boat which was making towards them, and being come near, made a sign to them in it to attend till they had done fishing. Their manner of fishing was so strange and new to our men that they were willing to comply with it. It was thus. They had tied some small fishes they call reverso by the tail, which run themselves against other fish, and with a certain roughness they have from the head to the middle of the back, they stick fast to the next fish they meet. And when the Indians perceive it, drawing their line, they hand them both in together. And it was a tortoise our men saw also taken by those fishermen. That fish clinging to the neck of it, where they generally fastened, being by that means safe from the other fish biting them, and we have seen them fasten upon vast sharks. Now, being from Iowa and living in Kansas, I have never heard of such a thing. The reverso they refer to is actually a remora described earlier. And I thought I hit a gold mine when I came across this little gem. Chris, is this fairly common knowledge for you marine folk? Or do you guys know about fishing with remora?
No. Well, to be honest, I've heard vaguely of this folks using remoras for fishing in just this fashion, but in the Pacific, in French Polynesia, but not in the Caribbean, where I imagine it was that Columbus witnessed this. Yeah, this is the first time I heard of it in this part of the world. That's fascinating.
So while this is the first mention, or I'd imagine this is the first mention of this practice in the Americas, and perhaps the first mention of some kind of fishing at all, it is not the only place that this method was observed, like you said. Many other explorers noted this method of take while sailing around different parts of Africa. Are these all the same species of remora, or are there kind of like a Caribbean species and then a more African coastal species, or are they all kind of the same thing?
Well, there's one very ubiquitous species. It's known as the suckerfish or the common remora. It's long and thin and has a bright white stripe that goes down its body. It's very conspicuous. That species is all over the world and in subtropical and especially tropical waters. And it's probably, if folks were in shallow water, that's what they were seeing. There are two other species that are much less common that are in the same group of remoras that hang out on reefs and hitchhike to fishes and turtles and sharks that frequent reefs. And then there's another group of five remoras that live a more pelagic existence and adhere, hitchhike, and suck onto billfish, swordfish, sailfish, marlin, things like that, pelagic rays, and then one species that sticks only to cetaceans like blue whales and sperm whales and dolphins. So it's likely that what they were encountering is this one species, the suckerfish or the common remora, Echeneus macrates is the scientific name.
Columbus described it as a certain roughness that held the fish onto its prey, while another explorer, Peter Martyr, described it in De Rebus Oceanis in 1511 as, "And upon the head it has a certain very tender skin which appears like a large purse, and when they see any large fish or reptile, throws over them this skin which he has upon his head." How is it exactly that these fish are able to latch on to others? Is it a certain roughness or is it a purse of skin?
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's actually a modified dorsal fin. So most ray fin fishes have this bony fin toward the center of the midline on the back. And many of those ray fin fishes have spiny fins. So they have, you know, very sharp spines. And so if you were to catch a largemouth bass or something like that, or a sunfish, you'd notice these spines very conspicuous and very strong and sharp. And it's a modification of those spines, actually. It's extraordinary that has formed these bony plates that we call lamellae. And those lamellae form these serialized partitions that are embedded in the suction cup. And that suction cup, along with the lamellae, allow them to adhere to whatever surface they want to stick to. I mean, if you've ever been diving on a reef, well, many folks that have been diving on reefs have noticed that, a remora will stick to their water tank or their neoprene. And so they're capable of sticking to a wide host of surfaces, be they rough, smooth. And these lamellae compartmentalize the suction disc, this modified dorsal fin, such that, you know, just one of these little compartments can provide a lot of suction. And if a few others fail, then these others can hold on fast. And so it's this modified dorsal fin buried in this suction cup that permits them to stick to all these things that are moving fast and bending and diving deep and have rough surfaces or smooth surfaces. All these challenges are met with this modified dorsal fin.
And when they stick onto one of these other fish, is it a parasitic relationship? Is one gaining more benefit than the other, or is it commensalism, where one benefits and the other sees no effect?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I still think it's an open one, though there's been some recent work. A colleague of mine has looked at how much drag a remora would impose on its host. And you could think of that drag as being parasitic, right? If, say, one of these big remoras was stuck to, say, a dolphin, that dolphin would have to eat, you know, so many number of more fish in a day, say, to overcome the parasitic drag that's imposed by swimming around with this thing stuck on the side of the body. But that tends to be pretty minimal, you know, say for a remora, some considerable size that would stick to a dolphin. This colleague that I spoke of, I believe she reasoned that it would only be, you know, just a few more grams of food a day that a dolphin would have to eat. Now, some dolphins, some sharks, even some other bony fish that are parasitized, if you want to call it that, by remoras, they may have a half dozen remoras. And now we're talking about maybe a considerable parasitic drag load. So it depends on how many remoras are on there. And there is some indication that there could be a commensalism, that is, both species are experiencing some benefit, both the host and the remora, in that many of these pelagic remoras that I mentioned that adhere to billfishes, their stomachs are loaded with copepods that typically parasitize the gill structure, the gill tissue behind the opercular cavity on the side of a fish. And if that's the case, there are many anecdotal accounts and pictures, even on the internet, of these remoras slipping out of the gills of billfishes as they're being caught. It seems that these, at least for a few species, it may be commensalistic in that the remora could take that free ride, maybe impose some parasitic drag on the host, but also in exchange remove the what we would certainly think of as damaging parasites that are in the gill chamber that are destroying the gill tissue that's important for respiration.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned the drag that the remora produce when they're hitching on these other fish. And while fishing with remoras is quite fascinating, it's not the first mention of them in history. Pliny the Elder, a Roman author, naturalist, and natural philosopher, wrote this of the remora in his book Naturalis Historia in 77 to 79 AD. So it's pretty old information here. The echinus is a small fish that is often found on rocks. It has the ability to slow the passage of ships by clinging to their hulls. And it goes on, but we'll stop there. Did people really believe that this fish could stop a ship?
Yeah, that was as you mentioned, Pliny the Elder proposed this, or at least reported this, and that for many years, mariners thought these fish slowed down their boats. And of course, you know, if these boats were in the right place at the right time, they could often be covered by dozens, hundreds of these remoras. And of course, if you saw something sticking to your canoe, you know, if you were out paddling around or your kayak, of course you'd think, you know, this thing's jutting out, it's slowing me down. You know, that drag, as I mentioned before, it seems to be not so much for any individual fish, but with dozens on their hundreds, then, you know, they may not, all those centuries ago, they may not been too far off that these things could have in some even just marginal way be slowing down a vessel by imposing some drag.
So you mentioned that you or one of your colleagues has done a little work with looking at the amount of drag these things produce. Have you ever calculated exactly how many would be necessary to stop an old sailing vessel?
No, but that would be interesting. I think you could go to this paper that I mentioned by this colleague. I'm sure we could go to the paper and just multiply and just do the algebra to figure out just how many it would take to slow down a ship going at a certain speed. You know, fluids are a fickle thing. They're hard to figure out. There are often nonlinear relationships between fluids and structures and the forces they impose on one another. So it wouldn't be maybe as easy as I'm making it sound, but it wouldn't be too difficult. I think with the data we have, we might be able to get to an answer. It would be a completely academic exercise, but maybe fun. But no one's ever quite figured that out.
someone back in the day must have thought that it must have happened to them before, because the ancient Greek translation of the genus for the white or live shark suckers, echinus, literally means to hold a ship. Echin meaning to hold, and nos meaning a ship. And another species, the common remora, remora or remora, is another example. In Latin, remora means delay or hindrance. Mm-hmm. So it's just further proof that they really believed this back at the start of the ADs.
When you see these fish, as a matter of fact, tonight I was watching Blue Planet 2 with my kids. I got 2 6-year-olds, and they love watching their stuff. And, you know, we were watching an episode focused on reefs, and there are all these sharks swimming around. And, you know, they're loaded with Echinus nacrates, this common remora, shark sucker. And you just look and you think, geez, that's got to be slowing them down. So, I don't think it's outrageous that these folks back in the day, it was a, I would say, an intuitive interpretation that these animals could have been imposing a lot of drag on whatever they were stuck to. But as I mentioned, fluids are fascinating in the way that they interact with structures moving and not moving. And when folks have made these calculations and studied fluids, but, you know, the bigger the host, the less of the effect it might be on just a scale basis, but also bigger hosts swim in a medium or in a way that's a little bit different than smaller hosts. And so the bigger the host, probably the less parasitic drag there would be. The flow field around that big organism is a little bit different. And of course, the folks back in the day didn't have an understanding of fluid dynamics and mechanics like we do today. So seeing even many of these remoras on a big whale or a big shark, like I said, it would be an intuitive interpretation to suggest that they were imposing a lot of drag.
So we've talked about the ingenuity of some indigenous peoples fishing with them and naivety of the ancient Romans, but there's still more fascinating things about the remora. Our pal Pliny also went on to write, "It is also the source of a love charm and a spell to slow the litigation in courts, and can be used to stop fluxes of the womb in pregnant women and to hold back the birth until proper time. I later read in another source that the love charm was actually a fix for premature issues in men. They would grind up remora and place it in a potion to fix that and to slow fetus development. Surely this isn't common practice over there on the coast, is it?"
No, I don't think so. This is the first I've heard of this. This is fascinating. Yeah. No, I've never heard of this. I've heard of Pliny talking or writing about remoras way back in classical times, but this is the first I've ever heard of it used in any pharmaceutical way.
I don't see any TV commercials about ground up remora anymore, so I'd stick to
whatever a doctor would prescribe before grinding up your own remoras. But I'm not a doctor, so, at least not a medical one.
So the reasoning was behind it was that they thought that if these fish could stop a ship, that they could stop ejaculation and pregnancies, as well as court processes, I guess. And it must have worked at least once for Pliny to write about it, or else what's the point?
Right.
So we already kind of discussed that there's probably no science to this. It just coincidence happened back then and they thought it was cause and effect type of situation.
Yeah. I've never heard of, even the consumption of remora for food is a rather rare thing. You know, they're mostly head, right? There's not much to them other than that head and disc system with a little bit of meat on the tail. They don't have much locomotor musculature, which is usually what folks eat on a fish because they're hitchhiking, or at least most of them are hitchhiking quite often. But yeah, I've never heard of anybody in contemporary times grinding up a remora as for some pharmaceutical or health benefit, yeah. But to each his own, right?
It might be the next new craze, so who knows?
It could be, yeah. Move over blue pills.
It's just when we started to form the idea that perhaps the natives were a lot less naive than the Europeans, I read that the Malagasy, or the natives from Madagascar, would place a necklace of dried remora around the neck of an unfaithful spouse to get them to stick around. And I'm sure there are all sorts of other weird old fish beliefs out there from days of old. Chris, do you know of any additional ones off the top of your head?
Yeah, I've heard of hanging fish in Asia to keep demons away, hanging dried fish, fish that follow you or good luck. Of course, you know, hanging shark jaws, fishermen will keep sharks away. There are so many, you know, our existence has been tied to the sea for so long that the lore and the explanations of supernatural and what have you, it just seems to be a part of, you know, so many of our cultures that, yeah, these stories of fish being important, of, you know, harbingers of storms, of love, of bad luck. Yeah, there are just so many of them. Not one in particular comes to mind. There's just so many of them.
If any listeners out there know of any, you can tweet them at me at fisheriespod using the hashtag fishfallacies. Or if you know any cool little known facts like fishing with remoras, you can use the hashtag fishfacts. And you can also post them on this episode announcement on Facebook. Now we're down to the final five questions. This is a group of five questions that I ask each of the expert guests that come on the show. And I usually say enough with the hard questions. Let's have some fun. But that was a pretty fun group of questions we just had.
Indeed.
Regardless, we always start really simple. What is your favorite fish?
Oh, my favorite fish. Oh, remoras are right up there. I've been working on remoras for a while now. But I'd have to say my favorite fish is something I studied. It's a group of fishes, but I'll just choose one species within that group. A species that I studied as a graduate student. It's known as the stoplight loose jaw. Some of your listeners may have heard of this thing if they're fishophiles and know something about deep sea fishes. This is a fish that just does so many outrageous things. First of all, it's black and it has huge eyes and huge jaws and huge teeth. And it lives, anywhere from 1,000 meters to 4,000 or 5,000 meters below the ocean surface in the complete blackness of the deep sea. It can consume prey items that are, you know, half its body length or even more. But the most spectacular thing is that they produce red light with a red photophore, a bioluminescent organ that surrounds the eye. And that red light, because of the nature of light in the deep sea, it's mostly blue down there. Any light that penetrates the deep sea is in the blue spectrum. And any light produced by any other organisms other than this dragonfish, this loose-jawed dragonfish, is blue as well. So they use this red light, we think, as some stealthy mechanism to illuminate prey without the prey knowing they're being illuminated, because, of course, their eyes are adapted to seeing in what is the more typical blue wavelength. And even more spectacular than that is that to see this red light, it seems that they have somehow co-opted chlorophyll. So every once in a while, they eat a copepod that snacks on phytoplankton. A copepod that goes to the surface at night and then comes back down. They snack on this phytoplankton, and they use this as some way to take red photons and convert them into blue photons, so that they could use a blue-sensitive photopigment in the back of their eye to see this red light. So they do so many spectacular things. They look like aliens in there, and they do things that are just, they're almost alien in themselves, things that no other fishes do at all. So that would be my favorite fish, the stoplight loose jaw.
Well, that's one that I've never heard of before, so thanks for educating me a little bit on that.
Sure.
What is your favorite memory from your career thus far?
Oh, my favorite memory. Oh, God, there's so many of them. I get teased a lot by my colleagues who aren't fish folks about how fanatical I am about fish. And, you know, the fish themselves, you know, I just shared a story with you what my favorite fish was. You know, even more than the fish themselves, and this sounds like a cliche, but it's true, is, you know, just the people and the travel. I've been to Japan, I've been all over Europe working in museums, Australia, New Zealand, field work in the Atlantic and the Pacific. If I had to pick one aspect of that, of all that work that's been most enjoyable or most memorable, I'd have to say it's been the field work. Off of New England here, and there's a large seamount chain that's right off the continental shelf. That's really how I cut my teeth in marine biology and fish biology, and got to know a little bit about these deep sea fishes, and just seeing these things come up almost alive. We were catching them with nets, and deep sea fishes are pretty fragile, but seeing these things alive, sometimes alive, and we keep them in aquaria and they'd be swimming around and they'd be luminescing. And just to be out in on the high seas and putting a net in the water and not knowing what we would get was just thrilling. And then when we would pull up the back of the net and dump what's called the cod end, and the net would fish for hours, we'd just get about 5 gallons of biomass, and most of it was about half of it was fishes. And we just didn't know what was going to come up in the next trawl, and that was just so thrilling. And I'd say that first time going out to sea and catching these deep sea fishes was most memorable.
What is your dream job or dream location that you would want to work in?
Well, I kind of have a dream job. That's kind of a cop-out, but I get to work with fish. Today I was swimming eels in the lab, and I get to, as part of my job as a professor, I get to train very young scientists, folks who have never done any research, train them in vertebrate physiology, fish physiology, and biomechanics, and maybe a little systematics, ecology. And I realize that most of these students are going to go on to graduate school or some professional school, be it dental school, medical school. And this will probably be the only time that they study fishes or, get their hands literally dirty with some organismal work, that is, working on whole organisms that aren't humans. And so I love that aspect of my current job, working with the young researchers that they come to this with no knowledge of, essentially no knowledge of vertebrate biology, other than human biology, and it may be the last time that they do it, but man, do we have fun. It's a lot of fun doing this work and making discoveries. I feel these students are really instrumental in gathering data and making insights into how fishes swim and feed, how their morphology and anatomy and physiology is important in whatever ecology they might exploit. In this current position, I get to do all that research and teach, and teaching is just a lot of fun. Keeps me on my toes, and there's no better way of learning than teaching, as the cliche goes. So I'm having a ton of fun in this and in what I'm doing now. I really enjoy it. I'd just like to keep working with undergraduates and in the lab and in the classroom, and I'll be happy doing that for a long time.
Well, you mentioned that you've traveled all over the world doing field work, and you have a fair deal of research projects going on there at Boston College. If money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
Oh, wow. Oh, that's great. Yeah. It's, I've thought about that. I imagine many scientists have, but in the real world, we typically don't ever think of that sort of liberty, having the liberty of endless supply of money, endless funding for whatever we want. We think about proposing these projects that could be within some limited budget and could be funded by some funding agency like the NSF or someplace like that. But, over the last few years, I've gotten more interested in developing instrumentation for whatever need we have in the lab. That's led to some work in understanding the mechanics of tissues, skin, and bone as fishes are swimming. But that's led me away from the deep sea. And I feel like I'm very exposed right now. I don't know if I've ever mentioned this to anybody before, but I'd like to, work on some things that are pretty high risk and would take a lot of money that involve instrumentation. Maybe because I worked with deep sea fishes and understand how important the production of light is, and their bodies are studded with these photophores, these luminescent organs. Just every square micron is covered with a something that could produce light. I'd love to build some instruments and things that can vary light, intensity of light, and pattern of light, and test some hypotheses. So what the heck is going down there with the use of these photophores? Does a particular pattern elicit a behavioral response? Could we even bait in some of these midwater dragonfishes that are so important to the ecology down there and actually use light as a way to study how they move, what they eat, and of course, how they communicate with light in the first place? So that'd be pretty high risk and would require a lot of money. And I'd love to work with some engineers. You know, this would require getting out on a boat and doing this stuff and deploying these devices and then retrieving them. That would be a lot of fun. But as I said, it's pretty high risk. And yeah, if money wasn't an option, that's probably at the top of the list of what I'd like to do.
Well, that definitely sounds like an interesting project. And if you were ever able to, I'd definitely invite you back on the podcast to talk about it.
Well, let's plan on it.
And the final question, if there was one point or principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
Oh, God, anybody that knows me, this is they would know the answer to this question before it was even asked. You know, as I mentioned, I spent a lot of time teaching undergraduates and working with undergraduates in a lab. And I teach every semester, I'm teaching a course in vertebrate physiology, comparative vertebrate physiology. And of course, humans as vertebrates, studying fish in some way is a vehicle for understanding our own physiology. And so at Boston College, a lot of pre-medical folks who want to go into medical school. And the first thing I mentioned to them on the first day of class, this is maybe something I'd like the viewers to take away from any listening to any conversation of fishes, is that we are fishes. And that's not just an academic statement. It gives us the power to understand where so much of our own anatomy and physiology came from. We are just a particular group of fishes. It's, you know, we're humans, we're primates, we're mammals, we're tetrapods, we're lobe-finned fishes, we're bony fishes, we're jawed fishes, we are all those things. And along the way, in the course of evolution, when we split off from our fish groups, we took things with us, like our cranial nerves that allow us to suckle as mammals and speak in complex ways as humans. You know, even some of or much of our genomic architecture, like say what gives us color to our skin and our hair, what assembles our fingers and five on each hand and toes and five on each foot. Those are things that we got from our ancestors, and those ancestors were fish. And, you know, we are fish. We have, as Neil Shubin, a very famous fish biologist and paleontologist, says, we have this inner fish. And I guess that's what I'd like folks to take away from any discussion as fish, is that we are fishes, and by studying them, we can gain a huge amount of insight into how we work.
Well, Chris, thank you for coming on the podcast today and helping me dispel some of these century or millennium old myths about remoras. If you ever want to come back on the podcast again to explain some of your other projects you have going on, the door is always open. And we'll go ahead and pencil something in for that deep sea photophore project.
Yeah. Well, you're very welcome, Nick, and I had a great time. And thank you very much for having me on.
All right. And if any of the listeners would like to get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
Well, you can go to my website, simply kenaleylab.com, kenaleylab.com. And there's email there, there's Twitter to get in contact with all those handles. So you can just head over there and give it a whirl.
If you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FisheriesPod. On Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email, feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. Also, be sure to check out tomorrow's fisheries blog, as it is a written version of this episode. You can find that at thefisheriesblog.com, on Twitter at fisheriesblog, or on Facebook, facebook.com/fisheriesblog. I hope that you enjoyed the 7th episode. Tune in next week when I'll have Bob Mallard on to talk about the Native Fish Coalition. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 7th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, we are all fishes.